Hello and welcome to the Hard Ball Gets AFL show. Josh Gallop here for Chris Robinson this week, who's away on leave. On the other side of the mic for the good chat, but we have a very special doubleheader with two of the AFL's most unique minds. Of course, as always, support is brought to you by Mazda. Drive the brand new Mazda BT50. It's the complete package. First up, good boy, Good Footy Energy's Brad Hollis, South Australian comedian and AFL savant, followed by former All-Australian ruckman, 291 gamer, Peter Spider Everett. That's coming up, so we'll get straight into it. Well, he's a comedian, a South Australian, a footy fan, and all of a sudden, a spiritual leader. Brad Hollis has carved out a piece of niche footy culture, and he's our first guest today in a massive double good chat. Brad, thanks so much for joining us, mate.
Thanks for having me on. Will I get to meet Talk to Spider, or is that
I probably should have lined that up. Sure, I should have thought it got another.
Crossing paths.
Mate, do you have a message for him or anything?
Yeah, not at the moment. I'll see if anything comes to me throughout the show.
Or one of the most cemented nicknames in AFL history. No one calls him Peter Everett, and if it's Peter Everett, you're like, oh, who? Oh, Spider, yeah, that's right. Can you think of any other good nicknames and then also your own nickname?
Some of my friends call me Snake. I think after Brattlesnake, because obviously my name's Brad, but I didn't know it because we were just at footy training once, and some of the older boys, they just started calling me Snake, but I didn't know why. For like the first year or so. And I just thought that was being really random, you know, just like being random to the young kid, you know, just like, yeah, the Snake. I was like, all right.
As far as nicknames go, Snake's pretty deadly. Like it sounds like you're this bad guy that probably don't want to catch on the wrong side of the tracks and stuff. We spoke about this on the other podcast, but when I met you in Adelaide, cause we were filming a documentary, it's about Brett Kirk. It was, again, somewhat of a classic moment of where we both had turmoil in our love life, didn't know each other, and then we've walked into this park near Adelaide Oval, and you've just dropped, like, in passing. Me and my girlfriend broke up last night, and I've just, like, looked at you, thought you were taking the piss, because I was like, is this guy got a mic in my room and he's taking the piss? Has he been spying? Because my girlfriend broke up with me last night. We're back together now.
Well, you were giving me hints.
Oh,
you were giving me hints that it, well, I don't know, something wasn't going. It was like you had a fight or something.
Ask me a personal question. Make this break the professional barrier and just be like, hey, Josh, what's really wrong?
Yeah. It's, you know, what's all that, you know, the mental health awareness. Speak up for you, you know, ask, are you okay? And I went with that, and I was like, this guy looks like he's hurting. He's putting on a brave face, but I can sense, you know, because I was also putting on a brave face.
I can't remember. I think you said, you whispered to me, Josh, there's a darkness in you. And at that point, I just broke down. But you know what? As soon as we did that, I knew that whatever we made that day would be a success. And arguably, the initial video we put out was a success, and the what's to come with the Brett Kirk thing, I have really strong things about that as well. But I feel like there was a trust that was brought upon from that moment. That was just me, though.
You don't think we were oversharing too early? And down the track, that might hurt us?
You know, I'm ready for the ride. I'm ready to...
Full throttle, baby.
For those that don't really know, so you recently celebrated your fifth year of recording comedy videos, big milestone. You've got about 71,000 followers on Facebook now. How did you get into it? Where did this start? And clearly, it started from like a love of footy.
I guess first I was just making comedy videos with my friends and doing a bit of stand up, and at the same time, I was getting into the spiritual side of life, a bit of a spiritual awakening, if you will. And then I can't really, just then I just kind of, and obviously I loved footy growing up, and then just converged those three things together, I guess, into a Facebook page. The three pillars, the Holy Trinity just coming together. And can you put some music behind this, just like some real some mystical music. Just
I think at my disposal right now, all I really have is
put in post.
Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Yeah. So there I was, a young 21-year-old. How old was I? I was looking for my path in life, you know. Going outside, looking up to the heavens, saying, who am I? Where am I?
You're in Adelaide, right?
I'm in Adelaide.
The numerology stuff, when did that start? When did you sort of start combining the three pillars as you spoke to earlier?
The numerology in the footy or in my own life?
Or do you adapt it to your own life? Or is it just a little fun thing? And when did it cross over to that footy?
I do look at that stuff in my own life. Not so much heaps anymore. Like, there was a period where I was maybe trying to work, you know, what does this mean? Or what does this number mean, sort of thing? Looking it up, like angel numbers on Google. But I don't do that really as much anymore. But I'm still obviously aware of that stuff. It's just a light, interesting thing. But yeah, probably pretty much when I started the page, I was into numerology at that point. I was doing some holistic healing course or something. They talk about it in there as well. They had to buy a couple of numerology books for that course. So I had them on hand when I was doing the footy stuff. I could look up like players. Life path numbers and stuff.
No, it's brought a lot of laughter and a lot of very diehard fans. And I think the first one I ever saw was the BT Grouse one, and that wasn't too long ago, but it was it got the rounds, and it was very popular. And it's the fact it actually sort of broke through the commentary bubble.
I remember I was there with my friend Fana, who I only just met a couple of days before, and I stood up and I gave him a hug.
And actually made it towards BT. Have you ever actually had any direct contact with BT, despite messages either way?
No direct contact. My mum ran into him once at she went to some Triple Ed thing, and she was like, "My son is the Grouse guy or whatever." And he was like, "Oh, I know your son," or something. But his son was the one who passed on one of the videos I did about him, saying I would love to see him say the word grouse on commentary, you know, because I'd never really heard a commentator say that before. And, yeah, his son showed that to him, and then a few weeks later he actually said it on air, which was pretty surreal, not surreal, but just a magical moment. I don't know.
As
Grouse, yeah.
Is he up there for your favourite commentators? Who's your sort of holy trinity of commentators?
Yeah, I think so. Him and JB, I like, especially when they're on the Triple M call. It's a bit more, you know how it is in the media, I guess.
Oh, yeah, big time. Big time's a bit very
the TV
serious.
Rules must be different to the radio rules. They're still good, of course.
No, you're right. They do seem
a little bit of a difference.
Very laid back comparatively. It seems like there's very little wiggle room, hence why Brett Kirk doesn't cut it. But just going back to your own upbringing, you've had you started in Adelaide. Obviously, you grew up in Adelaide. Your dad was a Port fan, which you spoke to a lot about before. But where does the comedy come from? Because we know where the sporting comes from. Obviously, footy and cricket are big in Adelaide. Where does the comedy in your life come from?
Probably my dad's side, I guess. My grandfather. Well, I just remember one, because I was thinking that a while ago. I was like, where did the comedy come from genetically? Just pondering that. And I think I just have memories of my grandfather, and I was all like laughing at like a roast dinner. You know what I mean? And so I think they like to laugh and tell stories or whatever.
You played a bit of representative football growing up, right? Because I saw you talking about that recently, as you actually had a bit of a story with one of the Port players.
Yeah, Sam Mays. Just at like the development squads for the SANFL teams, like under 16s and all that, and under 18s. And the story with Maisie was just because he obviously plays for Port now, and just having memories of like being at the training because there's, you know, a couple of groups. I'm not sure why. I'm pretty sure he's in my age or the year above, but he'd always just be there in his North tracksuit, but just standing around, because obviously he must have been playing state footy, so he didn't actually train with us. But he was just sort of you're just drawn to his figure. Like, who's that guy not training, you know? You're just naturally drawn. You must have an aura about him. Do you know what I mean? Do you ever have anything similar?
You're right about the state thing. There's always the guy cross-armed who seems to be able to
cross-armed.
Wide foot stance, always wide stance and cross-armed. And as you said, track pants, who, like, while all the battlers are all training as hard as they can.
Yeah, we're all training as hard as we can, just sweating it out.
This guy's so confident he's in the team. Like, oh, sorry, I'm in the better team. So I'm not going to train. And it's also that he can hold a conversation with coaches. It's like,
you
know, like, oh, I'm sorry, can you fuck off? You're 16 years old. They're actually taking his opinion on board. So do you have a favorite video? Is there a video that you remember doing and you're like, oh, I really like that? Because I find with my videos, people often say to you, that's the best video I've ever seen. And in my head, I'm like, oh, I've done ones I like better than that one.
Well, probably the most popular video potentially was the Fraser Garrett one. I don't know if you've seen that one. So it's about that footage of North Melbourne versus St Kilda when Garrett was playing, and it was like 20, 30 seconds left, 1 point in it, and St Kilda just comes streaming from the back pocket all the way down the centre, and Robert Harvey gets the ball, and there's just no one around him. I have no idea how he got that much space, for him. He's a gut runner. And he's just streamed through the middle of the Eddie had with the roof open, and he's kicked a long one to Garrick just on this massive lead, just like his aura. And they just, took the mark, hit the goal, won the game. And just, I remember when I first saw that footage of that video, pretty much immediately the ideas were coming for what I could do for the video. Of like, it got me quite excited. And like, there was a lot of emotion there, which I think some of my best videos have a lot of emotion coming through about whatever I'm talking about. And this was one where, but sometimes when you have a really good idea like that, it doesn't always come out or is received in the way that you feel it might from that initial excitement. But this was probably an example where I was really excited. The energy was there. It even took half a year to come back around to footy season until I actually filmed it. Did a couple of takes, and they were really strong energy, and just, I don't know, just, and then it did actually transfer onto the screen, and people liked it. So that was a rare case of it all just, it's just Fraser Garrett, man. Just, everyone is just resonating.
Yeah, he seems to have it. He even got even more of a bump recently with the pie incident, which obviously was a paid thing, but just sort of showed that there's still a thirst for Garrick.
It's like that, like we said, those full forwards, just their aura, mate. They're just, man, back in the day, they're like movie stars. I'm like Rocky, obviously Kappa, but like, just imagine like wearing earrings and suits.
Is there any sort of interaction with an AFL player or a fan that sticks out to you? And then we'll get to your submissions later, but is there anything that sticks out when you sort of like, wow, I've actually sort of, I've made my imprint on, you know, Australian AFL culture?
Tom Liberatore messaged me after I did a video on him after their premiership win. And that was pretty random. It's like Tom Liberatore, man.
What time did it come through?
What time?
It was about 6 a.m. or something.
Yeah, he was in Italy or something with Dowhouse, I reckon. So there was a bit of time. It was gone, I don't know what time. Sent in, or someone got a photo with him at like Fool's Festival wearing one of my early merchandise shirts, and they were doing the prayer symbol.
Oh, wow.
And I'm not sure if Tom did another photo, something to do with prayer. Anyway, that kind of, I don't know. That was, I feel like that moment was important in the whole prayer symbol becoming a bit of a symbol for the page. I can't remember the exact ordering, but I remember that Tom Liberatore in some way.
What are some of the best fan submissions? Because you're seeing a lot of different fans sending through Instagram or through the page itself.
Yeah.
What they're seeing, it feels like you're actually, you know, making people see the spiritual side of AFL footy. What are some of your favourite ones that have been sent in that you're like that really made you sit up in your chair and go, "Well, hang on a second, that's
yeah, I mean that, yeah, that's a big part of the page as well, is just people sending in stuff and me sharing it. And only like a couple of days ago, actually, some guy sent in for Kyle Langford, who plays for Essendon. He had like a couple of anagrams for his name, and one of them was Godly Flanker. And the other one was Dragonfly Elk. And then he wrote something spiritual about the meaning of dragonfly and that. And then someone sent in a photo of Kyle Langford's Instagram bio, and he actually has put Dragonfly Elk in his bio. And so that, like, someone must have sent the status to him, which that's a nice moment. It's cool when, like, what you post or what someone sends in makes its way to like that player.
Mm.
Some guy sent in the other day, you might have seen it. It was about when West Coast were playing Essendon, and it says there was a moment in like the last quarter or something where Alec Waterman and Jake Waterman were contesting for the ball and it went out of bounds, and they helped each other out. And then he said, as soon as they did that, the TV coverage put up a weather radar, and there was huge showers about to hit Optus Stadium. And the guy was like, I like to think that it was the two Waterman brothers coming together right at that moment to become the Watermen. And that was sent in by Jordan Weir. And some people were saying the last name Weir is, like a water.
Okay, so we had benoz.oz. He a message into the Hardball Gets Instagram page. If you haven't followed, please get on there. You can submit your questions each week for the pod. So he goes, "Hey guys, love the potty. I've come to the conclusion in the last few weeks that AFL commentators are all big key forwards from yesteryear. No matter where you look, it will be Pav on the boundary, Chief or BT in the box calling the game, Gary Brownie or Roo on the couch, and then a cameo of Jack Rerolt on the weekend. Just interested in gathering Brad's thoughts about this, and is it just AFL flexing our big bustling key forwards to the rest of Australians, or is it something a little bit more?"
Yeah, there is a bit in that. I guess that's their natural role, the big power forwards, is to sort of draw your attention. They're sort of prancing around, look at me, up forward there, and maybe it says something about the psyche of Australians, of what we want to be watching or tuning into. I mean, I'm sure they've done studies on that, the Fox footy and all that. Maybe, surely they're putting them there for a reason.
You see far less defenders on Fox footy.
I think that's just, the part of their personalities. That's why they're drawn to the forward line. It's all connected,
Well, it's not, I think,
kick it to me, I'll put some makeup on me, put me in the seat, put me up forward, and I'll do the rest.
I like that.
Josh.
Sorry,
I just had a seizure.
Doing a 21 Days of Gratitude on your Facebook, all right? And today was day one. So if those want to get involved, head to their Facebook. But you spoke about the King Brothers. Yeah. So this is day one of gratitude, what you're grateful for. Take it away, mate.
Yeah, I said I'm grateful for that the King Brothers, that they're both playing up forward, because one of them, like the McKay brothers, I guess, one of them's down back, one of them's up forward. I just like the fact they're both up forward. I just feel like that's an interesting comparison, seeing them at the two teams. I guess my plan was to have a whole bunch of things to, come up with a list for the gratitude. Obviously, I have to come up with 21 things. And I wasn't necessarily going to lead off with the Max and Ben King one, but I came to today and that's all I really had written down.
Brad, thank you so much for your time on today's pod. Is there anything else you want to add before we wrap up, or any message for Spider Everett?
Does Spider Everett do commentary? Maybe we could team up and do some sort of spider snake commentary. Maybe he could take me under his wing.
Spider snake breakfast radio program. So like a super commercial radio station. It's like Spider and Snake bringing you breakfast every morning for the week. And it's,
man, I'd love that.
And then
Get in there with Spider on a deadline coming up.
For those that want to check out more of Brad's stuff, head to the Facebook page. Yeah, good boy, good boy, Good Footy Energies, the Good Footy Energies podcast, and also Instagram, and also your weekly videos with the ABC. So thank you so much for your time, Brad, and look forward to seeing what else you do.
I look forward to you giving me a 21 Days of Gratitude.
Our second guest for the week was a true character of the AFL who arrived with dreadlocks, but as his appearance shifted, his spot as one of the AFL's best ruckmen became all the more apparent. Three All-Australian selections, 291 games across three clubs. Peter Spider Everett joins the podcast. Spider, thank you for joining us. Can I call you Spider still? Is that still your nickname?
Yeah, I don't think anyone actually really knows my real name. So even at work, everything's Spider, dot Everett, everything's, yeah. So a lot of people still ask me, what is your actual name? So, yeah, no, Spider's fine.
I noticed it's Spider with an A and not Spider. How did the – you've spoken about it previously, but for those at home, just explain how the name came about, because I've never seen a more cemented-on nickname.
Yeah, I just try and be cool, to be honest. I used to pretend and say, when I used to graffiti and tag trains down in Frankston, it was a lot easier to do the A rather than the ER. But, yeah, I don't know, just, trying to be cool at the time. I was, probably about 20, because my first original nickname was actually Stalker. So, which I'm happy I haven't got that nickname still anymore, but it was because I was all elbows and knees like a stork. But, I'm a lot happier and more comfortable with Spider these days.
And what are you up to nowadays, Spider? I understand you're up on the Gold Coast. What do you do with yourself up there, and how'd you end up on the Gold Coast?
Yeah, look, I keep still pretty busy. When I finished footy, I wanted to travel, and we do a travel show, Great Australian Doorstep. So we travel around Australia, caravan and camping, and showing people different places all around Australia. And we also now do motorhome tours to take people to where we go. So, like from Melbourne to Darwin, which I reckon is one of the great strips, one of the great roads, the Stuart Highway. And then we go from Darwin all the way to Perth, which again, the Kimberleys and then the west coast of Australia. And we've just chucked in a Queensland outback one. So, yeah, I think, what we've seen over the last couple of 18 months is that, a lot of people are starting to see parts of Australia that they've never thought they'd go and see, but, always wanted to. But this is their opportunity to go and see it. So, yeah, look, I love Australia. I love the outback, and that's what I've always wanted to be a part of, is being able to travel through there. So we did that, and then I got the opportunity to join a breakfast show on radio over on the Gold Coast. So that's pretty much why we based ourselves here, and I've been here now 10 years, and outside of the radio, just do the travelling stuff. So still pretty busy, which is great.
Let's start where you were a young talent, and that was in the Mornington Peninsula. You were one of the last products of the zone system to become a star in the AFL. Can you talk us through how the great John Beveridge ended up finding you and bringing you to the pros?
Yeah, it was interesting because, it was one of those last years. And when it was originally set up, I went down to play at St Kilda in the under-19s. So in the under-19s, they had St Kilda under-19s, and they had reserves and senior footy. So I was playing at Hastings at the time, and I didn't have dreadlocks, but I had my hair in beads. So it was pretty similar, close to it, and I hadn't even been to Bali. So it was just a choice. And I played against Gary Colling's sons, Cat, who was a coach of the under-19s at the time. And then him and Johnny Beveridge asked me to come down and play a few games in the under-19s. And I was under-17s, but played in the under-19s. And then I was lucky enough to, at the end of that year, they scrapped the under-19s and they kept certain players on to play in the seconds, and I was a part of that. So really lucky to be called up. But that was when, as I said, they had those stepping stones to be able to get to the AFL. So just scraped in by the skin of my teeth, but at the same time, just being in the right place at the right time.
That's right. And you mentioned the hair. The hair was a fixture of your entire sort of career, and there were many iterations. Where did this desire to always have a sort of a different look or a different hair come from at a young age? Was this just a coming of age that stayed with you your whole career? How did this come about?
I might have been scarred from early days of the boys at school used to pick on me and reckon I went to mummy's salon to get my hair cut because it was short back. Short sides and front, and then long at the back, like the good mullet, but it was so flat. It's so straight. They reckon I ironed it. It was that straight. It was putrid. So I think it was just scarred from early life saying, I can't have everyone thinking I've got the mummy salon ironed hair. So I kept changing it. So yeah, the dreadlocks, and then they fell out, and then I dyed it, and then I grew it long, and then I shaved it and put the side mohawk in. Don't know. Just kept on changing it just for the look, suppose, put a bit of self pressure on yourself, and then you've got to perform. But yeah, just the different hairstyles, it changed a fair bit. When you look back now, you think, what are you doing, you idiot? But anyway, at the time, it was good.
So 1993, you make your debut against Geelong. Your first kick's a goal, a little snap. What you don't see that is the adjustment to men's football. How long was the adjustment? You said you were with under-19s and playing in the reserves. How long was that period before you actually got made your debut for St Kilda?
Yeah, I think some of our earliest memories, even playing seconds footy, and, you know, I was never lucky enough to play at Moorabbin in the seniors, but in the seconds, and, you know, we'll be getting there changed, you know, in the change rooms, and, you know, you hear the crowd just screaming out, and then, you know, one of the trainers would go, oh, there you go, Pluggy's got the ball, and you could just hear it through the change rooms, and that's when the crowd would, you know, stand at one end of the ground, and then, you know, that all changed to go to the other end of the ground when Plug went to the other side of the ground as well. So, you know, you remember all those memories and the sound and the vibration coming through the walls at Moorabbin when, you know, big Plugger got the ball. So that was always in, you know, something you always remember. And, you know, your first game down at Geelong, driving all the way down there with my grandfather, and, you know, he said, oh, do you want a little nip of scotch? You know, that's what he gave my uncle on his first game, you know, playing at Werribee. And I was like, no, I don't think we can do that. But just having my old man and my grandfather there, and they loved it because they knew that, you know, I drove to the footy, that they could have a few beers and I would have to drive home because I wasn't drinking. So they said, how good's this? We get to see a game of footy and get a lift home. So, yeah, that whenever you kind of run out for your first game, it's now you're proud to be there and all, you know, you've done a lot of hard work, but you're nervous as well. And, you know, just to get your first kick a goal, just get that monkey off your back and just be able to even take a couple of marks. And as you say, be out there against not only, you know, the players you've trained with, but, you know, you're up against Geelong. So, you know, you got your Billy Brownless, your Stonehams, your Gary Hockings, your Gary Ablett's, these kind of blokes as well. So, you know, when you're going through the ranks of second footy, you still idolise and look up at these guys, and then suddenly you're on the field against them. So it's pretty surreal, but at the same time, when you're able to, you know, just get your hands on the ball, it kind of relaxes you a little bit.
You mentioned Lockett. You had two seasons with him on the field, 93-94. What do you remember of him?
Yeah, funny. I remember we used to always call him Plugger Laps because we would always have to run laps. And you'd have to run outside the boundary, except for Plugger. He could run 10 metres inside the boundary, and that would Plugger Laps. And even if we did 400 metres, he would always time our 400-metre runs because, you know, the tall, the bigger blokes would run together. And they'd say, righty, you got to run these 400s in, you know, 68 seconds. And, you know, would, because we didn't have GPSs, we'd time them ourselves. So Plugger would time our laps. And, you know, they'd be reading 73, 74, 75. He'd be yelling out, 66, 67, 68. So he got away with a lot. But even you know, they were the days when, you know, myself and Lazar Vidovic, you know, we were sharing the ruck roles. And even at training, you know, the coach Stan Ells would go, rightio, you got to drop into the hole in front of Plugger. You know, like if it was a Dunstall or an Ablett or whatever. You used to have to go and drop in the hole in front of the full forwards. And we'll do that at training. And we're like, mate, we'd have to strap a mattress to our back before we drop in the hole in front of Plugger. Because even if it was at training, he wouldn't give a shit. He'd still run through you and hurt you. So, yeah, he played that way. He trained that way. But, yeah, he was very he just kept to himself. And, you know, if he spewed up before the game, you knew he was going to kick 10. That was a basic rule.
That was the rule. Well, he kicked 109 goals in two seasons playing 20 games. Those sort of numbers are just completely unheard of nowadays. You mentioned Alves just then. He came in 94. You've said previously in a couple of interviews that when asked who the hardest player you played against was, you mentioned Primus, but you also said Alves was just one of the hardest because he was such a hard coach. What do you remember of the shift when he came in 94?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, Stan just really challenged every one of us and we weren't really kind of used to that. It was an eye-opener for a lot of the boys and, you know, later on, you know, past 94, even he started bringing some league teams and that was when you start, you know, evaluating yourself and where you sit in the way of professionalism and, you know, making sure that you're doing everything right. And, you know, there's a few of us, and me being one of those that, you know, just went along. You know, we thought, well, great, we'll play in senior footy, yet really never pushed or tested ourselves to our limits. So Stan really pushed that, and, you know, I think he got the most out of a lot of players. And, you know, the things he implemented and brought into the team, like, you know, that honesty sessions and, you know, some of the training techniques were a little bit different, probably a little bit early. You know, they're dime a dozen now, but Elsie really, yeah, tested each and every one of us in so many different areas. And one of them, not only just physically on your running capacity, but mentally as well. So that's why it was always, yeah, a big challenge, because you'd always challenge it, but always for the right reasons.
The change was gradual. You, your 13th finish in 94, 15th the year following, but then in 96 you made the jump to 10th as a club.
It was a funny time, because we knew that, you know, he was slowly trying to build a team, and footy's starting to change now too. Like, footy's starting to get a little bit more professional. You're starting to train at times when, you know, when you're playing, and, you know, starting to, you know, start consider recovery sessions. So all these things are starting to be implemented and change. So a lot of players had to change with that as well. You know, we were early in our career, so we'll just kind of, you know, work was starting to become a second option in 96, 97. Footy was starting to become a lot more full time. You know, players who had been around there a lot longer were starting to adjust with life, as footy's your number one priority, and then, you know, your family, and you're starting to fly into state days before rather than the day off. So footy started to really change, and, you know, Stan Els with, you know, brought in, you know, outside people to, you know, try and get us all on the same page and get us all working together and get us more professional. And, you know, you always had your superstars who did that no matter what, you know, your Robert Harvey, Nathan Burks and Stuart Lowe and these blokes. But it was about bringing, you know, more so myself and a couple of others, you know, from the people that, you know, just thought they'd float through up to actually, you know, caring and trying and actually challenging ourselves. So, yeah, it was a different time of football, but it was an interesting time from the time pretty much you started to your finish, because you went through that transition.
96, you started to see the change at the club. Ended up finishing 10th on the ladder, but you finished the year really fairly strong. Yourself against Adelaide in round 22, you kicked 7 goals, 7. You kicked 41 goals for the season.
Now, you mentioned 7-7. I remember when I kicked the 7-7, they told me it was the worst 7-7 they've ever seen, because every time I took a mark, it was 2 grabbers. It wasn't 1 grab. And they said, you know what? It's going to be 1 grab, not 2. And I was like, I still kick 7-7.
Surely the ends justifies the means in footy.
I would have thought so, but not always. Don't get ahead of yourself, I reckon. So even with 7-7, so no, it was that 96 season was one that started to change a lot for us and a lot for the footy club.
So 97, you've built some momentum the year prior, but you've come out and then you've lost 4 of your first 5 after a very strong pre-season. Do you remember the feel amongst the club after those first 5 rounds?
I remember the, clubs used to, like, prior to that, I gave away 100 metres to Crawf one day at Hawthorn. And it ended up being that, you know, it was the second or third biggest comeback in history when, you know, we were leading by, you know, 40, 50 odd points. I gave away 100, Hawthorn come back and won. And ever since then, we really struggled in the second halves. And, you know, clubs now, and even I remember early in that season, we'd go in at halftime up or close, and just that, the mental side of just whatever happens above the shoulders, and if anybody could ever get it right, that'd be a millionaire, is that third quarters, we always seemed to struggle. So third quarters, I'd always just come back, get on top, and then we couldn't get our game going again. So it was a real mental challenge that first 4 weeks to get that, you know, kind of, four-quarter effort, even though we knew that and we're going all right at half-time, would always falter in that third quarter. And you know, luckily we end up getting that right round 5 and 6. But, yeah, before that, that third quarter really hurt us.
Well, the season actually played out, obviously, very strong for St Kilda. What did it feel like when you've got the players that you had that year, Robert Harvey, and there were a lot of players by the end of their career, you've got Stuart Lowe, Matthew Lappin, Darryl Wakelin, Nathan Burke, all these players have played 200, 250 plus games. You know, now looking back, they were so accomplished and played so, had such good careers, but at the time you're just amongst a bunch of very sort of talented players.
And that's a hard thing. I think, you know, you can look back now and, you know, you look at a team on paper and, gee, what an unbelievable team when you look at how many players went on to play, you know, 200-odd games. You know, you even got Ozzie Jones and Justin Peckett, Jamie Shanahan. But you can go through the list of them. And
Barry Hall,
remarkable team. But the hardest thing, yeah, as you say, was absolutely just getting that to keep going on and on and on. Where, you know, we're still quite young, myself and, you know, Ozzie Jones and Pecco and these blokes were quite young. Lowy and Harv's now a little bit older. We think, you know, how good is this? This is going to go on each and every year. You know, well, unfortunately, we missed it. You know, we made it in 97. We didn't win it. But you know what? We still got 98, 99, 2000. That's what you think when you're young. You know, we've built a good team and we're going to be hard to beat. And, gee, they're hard to get there and then they're even harder to win. So that's probably, you know, that's difference between a group of young blokes and the group of senior guys. The senior guys knew how hard it was to get there consistently and stay there, where the young blokes thinking, you know what, this is going to happen every year.
Well, let's talk through the finals that year. So St Kilda get to the finals in top position. So after the stunted start to the season, they end up finishing the minor premiers and head into the qualifying final full of confidence. And the worst happens to yourself. You have a collarbone injury. Do you remember that vividly still?
Yeah, Darryl White. He's built like a toothpick, Darryl White, and he hip and shouldered me. I couldn't believe it. I already kicked a couple. And I was pretty happy and running back, and Darryl White just, yeah, hip and shoulder me and broke the collarbone. I remember the physio coming out saying, oh, give me a look at it. And I said, no, I can, you know, you can feel the bone rubbing on each other. So I said, no, I know it's broken. So I'm out. So I ran off and then, unfortunately that was the season. You know, these days they could probably pin it. They might even, you know, put a stitch through it and hopefully mend, you know, 4 weeks could be okay. But realistically, another big bump on that would have just done it again. So, yeah, it was devastating. But at the same time, as I mentioned before, you're thinking this is going to happen every year. Devastating for the year because how it panned out and, you know, we end up playing Adelaide. It would have been really good to have a good crack one-on-one duel with Sean Wren, who, you know, very similar kind of players and in the same kind of form. So would have been great to go up against him.
So the team goes on to go through to, they sort of walk through the preliminary final against North Melbourne, end up in against Adelaide. It's a huge moment for St Kilda because it's their first time back to the grand final in a very long time. Stan Alves has done the unthinkable in a pretty short period of time, really, only about three or so seasons. How hard was it watching on that grand final and even and then seeing the team lose?
Yeah, looking back now, you know, and it gets harder because it's so hard to get there, when you're in it, I didn't know, you know, I followed a little bit of footy in barracks for Collingwood as I was growing up, but not really going to AFL. And then when you're a part of the St Kilda Footy Club, and then we'll get onto Hawthorn and Sydney later on, and then you're out of the game now for a few years, and you know you do a few functions, and you go and have a chat to all the supporters, and you understand really what it means to them all. And you know, at that time in 97, you didn't really know, but St Kilda had so many, you know, everyone's second favourite club. You know, they've been just starved of success for so long, and you know, it would have just meant the world. It would have been an amazing feeling. It would have been great to be able to have those reunions, which unfortunately never happened. But at the same time, to be able to, you know, to sit in the grandstand, I sat there with, I remember Matty Young, because he was actually dropped the night before the game or two nights before the game for Robbie, can't remember his last name, but Robbie was injured for ages and Matty Young was dropped. So I watched it with Matty and, you know, as disappointing as we were, we thought, you know what, there's always kind of next year. But, you know, as we see, that wasn't the case.
That's right. Robert Harvey came away with the Brownlow that year. Chris Grant was suspended and couldn't win. Harvey claiming it. There was talk the year after in the preseason that he attacked that preseason like never before. The only other player to win an All-Australian in 1997 for St Kilda was yourself. How did you attack that preseason?
Yeah, I think we all, Harves was a freak. He trained he'd do his calf and then the physio or the doctors would go and be driving home. There's Harves running a 10K road run. It's like, mate, you can't do it. You've hurt your calf. Take a week off. You know, you got to get yourself right. So, he was a freak, but at the same time, we knuckled down and, we started really pushing each other ready for that 98 season. But, I still remember Harves, winning the Brownlow on that night saying that, he felt a bit in the victory because Chris Grant was suspended and the way to come out next year. And, I think he averaged something like 30 odd touches or just over 30 touches, over the year, which was remarkable. But, preseason from then really changed for all of us. I think even from 96, we realised that preseason had changed and it's more of a business. It's getting a lot more serious. Footy is full time come 97, 98.
Robert Harvey is now at the helm of Collingwood as the caretaker coach. Do you see his work ethic transferring to being a coach? Do you think he will be an effective AFL head coach?
Yeah, interesting. I'd love to see him get an opportunity. I think so. Harves is very quiet as a captain. He led by example, but when he spoke, everyone listened. But he was very, very quiet. He just went along, along with his business. And the coaches always used to say, you got to take other people with you. You drag Ozzie Jones, or you drag all these Tony Brown, or drag these younger blokes along with you. So there's definitely a lot of experience that he can pass on. And he was a very, very smart footballer. So he knew, the setups and where to run and how to run. So, I think it'd be great to give an opportunity. Will it be Collingwood? I don't know which way they're going to go. But, it'd be great to see him be a head coach. It's something he's always wanted to do.
The weirdest thing I saw when I was looking up this was Stanell's habit of doing the haka on Thursday night training that season. What was the story behind the haka on a Thursday night?
I don't know. All that I know is that this is no shit. He did this one day because we used to have to run down to one of the running tracks in Moorabbin, and it was about a couple of K run, and then we'd go down there and do our running sessions, 400s. It was a proper running track. And on the way back, I don't know how you do it these days, but we were in the middle of the highway there. What is it? The main road that runs through Moorabbin, St Kilda. It's four lanes of traffic each way. North and south out of the city. And we'd stand in the middle of it. So cars either side of us. And he'd be on the outside. And he'd be going, pointing left, pointing right, pointing left, pointing right. And we'd have to do the kind of the haka and move to his signals in the middle, like on a traffic island, in the middle of Moorabbin. It was bizarre. And I don't know. I think it was just one of those mental things, but he loved it. He, after training, in front of the whole crowd, we'd all have to stand there and he'd point his fingers left, right. When he pointed down, we had to go down and then jump back up and sit there. It was a bizarre time, but it was as dumb as it was a bit of fun. It got the boys up. We had a bit of a laugh and jumped around and, it was just one of those silly things. I think Richmond tells jokes. We did the haka.
Right. So taking the haka into the 98 season, you guys started on fire. You won five of your first six, one in particular against the West Coast Eagles. You had 26 hitouts, 14 disposals and kicked 6-3 in a two-point win for St Kilda at Subiaco Oval. Does this one stand out for you at all?
Yeah, it was my birthday, May the 3rd. Daniel Healy kicked the same. We both kicked six apiece, so which was quite fascinating. And I texted him the other day on our birthdays and say, I remember, I think it was about, it might have been 20, was it more than 20 years ago? What year was that? 98.
That was 98, yes. So that was 23 years ago,
Yeah, and I texted him the other day saying, do you remember this? And he goes, who's this? I said, Spider. But, West Coast was always, some of those challenges. And look, I was very fortunate enough to play in a great position, which is in the ruck. So you're going to go against not only some of their some of the best players in the comp is in the ruckman, but also, you know, trying to battle our midfield against their midfield. And we know what their kind of midfield was when, you know, they had a full classy midfield, and so did we. So, you know, it was always a challenge flying over to WA. And even I remember Stan, because whenever you fly into state, you know, you try and think what's going to work. This is all new to everyone, you know, flying into state, staying overnight, getting up, making sure you're ready, trying to stay in your same routine so when you get to match time, everything's the same. And we went over to Perth and Stan Al said, all right, we're running on local time. So we got up at like 4 o'clock in the morning or 3:30 in the morning, local, because it was going to be local time for us. So daylight savings, whatever it was, we're up at 4 in the morning, walking down past some beach, kicking the footy. People were yelling and screaming, shut up, go to bed. And there we are, trying to keep on local time. Our normal body clock time to see how it would go. So, yeah, even when we come up to Brisbane one day to play, we weren't allowed to open our blinds. He said, don't open your blinds, don't look at the beach, don't look at the sun. We're not here for a holiday, we're here to play footy. I don't know how we went, but, they were the weird things some of the coaches brought in. But, yeah, I remember that. It was on my birthday, that 6-3.
That season was really interesting. You guys finished in round 14, you were on top of the ladder and first, but in the last 8 rounds, you lost 7 games and sort of scraped your way into the finals. What was going within the club within that period to see sort of the drop off?
Yeah, that was, again, you know, above the shoulders, just trying to rework everything and trying to, you know, over those period of times, it's so hard to nut one thing out because it's just that mindset, that belief, and you try and train every different way, and coaches say, okay, we're going to train harder. No, we're going to have a week off, or we're going to go and have a few beers, or we're going to go to the movies, or we're going to try soccer, or we're going to go back to... It's such a difficult time, but it's just that, you know, and as soon as you get onto a bit of a losing, I suppose, streak like that, and, you know, you look at Richmond at the moment, and, you know, we mentioned last night with the Gold Coast Suns and the week before with St Kilda. So suddenly sides just find that extra leg as well. You know, I think, you know, what these sides are beatable. How do they do it? And then you start to believe. And, you know, if I'm on the opposition and we're going up against somebody, we remind them each and every time, hey, boys, you're a bit thingo at the moment. You're, you know, a bit wobbly at the moment. And it just starts to play in your mind. So that was the hardest thing. And then obviously just getting to the finals and then hoping, you know, things might change around.
So in the finals, it's back-to-back losses against Sydney and Melbourne, a blowout against Melbourne, and that sees Al sacked as head coach despite making the grand final a year prior. Talk us through that. How was that received by the club and received by the playing group?
Yeah, look, there's a lot of questions asked the weeks before that, and Stan spoke to the group and spoke very, very passionate about, you know, look, he's here just to make us better. It's not him, you know, it doesn't faze him. Like, he'd love to be a part of this football club. And he spoke well, and all the players were kind of behind him as well. But, you know, Trevor Barker also did pass, you know, and was a really good conduit between, you know, the coaching staff and the players. So that was a big loss during the time for the footy club as well. But, you know, it surprised a lot of us because we always thought that, you know, Stan would be, well, these days he would have warranted another year making the finals and having just one bad, you know, final series or, you know, bad end of the season. It happens, you know, to a lot of clubs. So, yeah, it was a shock. But at the same time, I think as a player, you sit there and go, well, you know what, we made the grand final a year ago. A new coach coming in with some new ideas, we could get quite easily back on track. And so the enthusiasm quickly, you know, changed to that, saying, you know what, new coach, new type of footy, something to look forward to.
So the next couple of years after that, yeah, Tim Watson for one season, Malcolm Blight for a single season, and then Grant Thomas took the helm prior to Ross Lyon stepping in, but you were at Hawthorn by that stage. It must have been weird as a player going from the height of heights, a grand final, as you said, being so close to a premiership, to then such turmoil the following season. So the following seasons, you guys finished second last, and dead last. In 2000, you finished dead last. and 10th in 1999. So you spoke to earlier, you sort of think as a young player that success is easy.
Yeah, and look, every coach had different ways of wanting to play, and, you know, Tim Watson had different ways of Malcolm Blight, and the hardest thing is we still had a good side. You look at the side still on paper, not a lot had really changed. A few of our, all their guns were still running, big, your Harveys and Burks and all that were still running around and still being a part of it, and brought a few younger players in. So it wasn't like nothing had changed. The side had changed completely. It was just a mindset and a matter of, being able to, just put it all together. And that was the frustrating thing. And, unfortunately, people say that, St Kilda were a drinking team and, we partied too hard. But, every time I went out, and that wasn't every weekend, but North Melbourne were out just as much or even more than us, but there wasn't two or three of them. There was like 30 of them. And that team mentality, made them, they were playing finals where, we were totally branded as a drinking team, but we weren't playing finals. So it was a frustrating time, I think, for a lot. And just the uncertainty at top level as well. Normally, you look at your board and you look at, the coaches always changing. It was just that speculation. The more time, you lost, the more speculation around a coach. And then, that was written up a lot. And unfortunately, that was the life and, the story of the St Kilda Football Club, unfortunately. It had been for a long period of time.
Do you see like a team like Collingwood this year, and sort of does that resonate with you, what would be going on with the playing group, is when you have instability with the three pillars in your CEO, your president and your coach, does that filter through to the playing group?
Yeah, for sure. And you could see that. You can see that with the playing group, and it's frustrating. We had to do that nearly each and every year. But
I need to ask you about the round two against Melbourne, 1999, if you don't mind me asking. There was the slur against Scott Chisholm, a four-match self-suspension and a $20,000 fine. Now, you were so young at the time, and looking back now, what do you remember of that period and what do you remember of that moment in your career?
Yeah, look, I remember having a crack at Scotty. We were having a crack at each other throughout the game, and yeah, got a goal, and we had a crack at him, and obviously it was caught on camera and reported, and the first player to go through the racial vilification system. At the time, he didn't want to talk, didn't want to mediate, so I went to the tribunal throughout some of the institutions in Melbourne, which was great to be able to do, and then $20,000 fine. So as harsh as the penalty was and as hard a time it was, for myself, I accept that what I said was wrong, but, when you've got a daughter who's in grade 3 at the time, doesn't understand why everyone's picking on her at school, or, your mum and dad getting letters and that dropped off in the mail, and sister getting picked on, or having people having a crack at her at work, you don't realise how much ramifications it has outside of just yourself. So that was a really hard time. The media sleeping outside your place trying to get a shot of you walking inside and trying to get comments off you. So a tough time. And since then, I've been fortunate enough, and I know we're going to touch on Sydney a little later on, but ran into one of Adam Goods's aunties, and when I retired, I went out 300 k's out west of Alice Springs and spent a day out there in one of the Indigenous communities. And ever since I've retired, I've had a really good relationship, and I've had, a great opportunity to be able to go to a lot of the Indigenous communities throughout Australia and do bits and pieces. So, it was tough at the time, but what I learnt and what I've been able to continue on with has been, I think it's been awesome. And really proud to be able to do so much work in that area now. But at the time, it was through lack of education and, unfortunately out there on the day.
One thing that stood out for me is you played this start of your career with Nicky Winmar, who obviously is in in a statue out the front of Optus Stadium now for his moment with St Kilda. Did you ever speak to Nicky about this, even though that season he wasn't playing for St Kilda?
Yeah, not so much. You know, I remember my first training session was on Cracker. And so we had Gilbert McAdam, and you know, Nicky was one of our good friends down at St Kilda. We did a lot of stuff with him. You know, that fourth game I ever played with Nicky at Victoria Park was that actual statue when he lifted up his jumper and pointed to the colour of his skin. So, look, it was more so of just, I suppose, the tone and the language and just you know, the way you say things and you know, the backstory behind it all. So, if it wasn't, you know, Nicky, I've got a lot of Indigenous mates, so, you know, I hadn't spoken to Nicky absolutely on that, but we still had a lot of Indigenous boys around the football club, and, you know, it's one of those things now where, you know, you regret, but at the same time, you know, you learn and understand from it.
So 2003, you then head to the Hawks. What did it mean for you then to sort of have a new start then at Hawthorn?
Well, I think that was the main thing about the whole lot was the fact that, you know, I was at St Kilda, didn't have the greatest reputation, found myself on the front page of a lot of papers rather than the back page. Football was, I was going okay. I wasn't, you know, setting the house on fire, but, you know, the perception out there was that I didn't really give a crap about football. So I would love to have changed that perception, and I thought the only way I've been able to do that was by going to a different club. And, you know, I actually met down and nearly signed on, well, pretty much agreed to terms with Collingwood. And you know, I didn't get a say in where I went and what I did. So Grant Thomas wouldn't deal with Collingwood. And he said, no, the deal we got is you're going to go to Hawthorn. So ended up going to Hawthorn, which was great, and had the 4 years there. But, you know, it was about that perception. I wanted to change the perception of myself, saying, you know what, I can actually play football and I'm not so much of a fool that everyone thinks I am, which I don't know if I did. But
well, 2005, you got back to an All-Australian level form. Was that the most satisfying of those nods that you had over your career?
Yeah, look, you don't look at personal achievements, but I think, you know, changing, going to a different football club is always hard. You know, and you've got to try and perform as well, and you know, you're coming into a great midfield, and you know, you've got players, you know, like, you know, Crawford there, who you're respecting. He's coming off a Brownlow himself, and you're coming in as their number one ruckman. So yeah, look, it was satisfying, and also to win a Peter Crimmins award as well. So like, you sit there and go, you know, you just feel satisfied that you're able to deliver something that you've wanted to be able to do, and that is, you go to a different football club and play good footy, because that's what your job is, to play good footy and hopefully succeed as a team. So, yeah, in a way, you know, very, very happy to be able to play some good footy.
Speaking about Crawford, you played with the Brownlow medalists at St Kilda and Harvey, and then you played with Crawford at the Hawks. A ruck rover or a midfielder is only as good as his ruckman. Who was the easiest to
Thank
deliver
you. The... Thank you. Finally, somebody's listening to me. I was going to say I won Robert Harvey 2 Brownlows. I couldn't get Crawford 1, but look, you can't really... two different players, you know, when you look at... you know, Harves was... You know, both of them were a machine. I remember Crawford doing a beat test, and I thought he would have gone a little bit longer. I can't remember exactly what he pulled out at, but thought he would have gone a little bit longer. And then the next team started, you know, the next group started, and he ran in that one and won it. So back-to-back beat test is just amazing. But both of them are just as good as each other. You don't win a Brownlow off, you know, realistically off ruckman or forwards or backs, you know, midfielders, they win it off the back. The way they train and prepare and get themselves right. And, you know, you got to think they're getting hassled and tackled and smashed each and every game and headhunted. You know, both of them, great players.
2005, Alistair Clarkson arrives at Hawthorn. Now he's a four-time premiership coach. He's lauded as this coaching savant. What was your first impression of him rocking up at the club?
I remember ringing him a couple of days beforehand and said, "We're having a barbecue with a few beers. Do you want to come and you know, meet a few of the boys?" And he said, no. When I get there on Monday, I'll hit them straight between the eyes and they know what I'm here for." And, yeah, that's pretty much what happened. So, yeah, look, he came in with a really, really strong plan and a really, eye for exactly what needed to be done. He brought a lot of people with him, training changed. You know, even now, you know, the fitness of the Hawthorn guys went up, you know, a level when you didn't think it could. He really challenged us to make sure it does go up. Took us to Kokoda, really, you know, talked about, you know, the sacrifices you make around football. And saying that too, coming into a very, very young, confident list. You know, you got Buddy and Ruffy in a draft. You already had Sam Mitchell, Luke Hodge, Chance Bateman, Jordan Lewis. So, you know, if you got a good group of young guys and you're able to carry those through, did extremely well. But he knew exactly how he was going to tackle this, and he had the right people behind him too.
We have Xavier Ellis that does a bit of work with West Australian. He remembers Lance Franklin coming into training, and normally when there's a young guy on the list, he's easy to get to as far as a tackle because there's nothing on at this stage. But he reckons straight away Franklin was sort of don't arguing and pushing players off and booting it from 50. Was that what you remember of an early Franklin?
Yeah, I remember doing, you know, if it was 200s or 300s or 400s, you know, we'd have our main running group and he'd just glide with the main ones. And he's 6'4", 6'5". He'd just glide with the main sprinters and we're like, oh my God. And then they'd actually take it in turns to run with him because he'd never push himself or challenge himself. So, you know, you got our main runners running with a 6'4", you know, mid, you know, centre forward, but running like a midfielder. He was extremely confident and he still plays that way. That's why he's so good, because you still need that little bit of arrogance and confidence about you. So, yeah, no, he was, as soon as he walked in, you knew he was going to be it.
2006, you had another good season in the Hawks, but there was a bit of a contract negotiation breakdown. Can you talk us through what actually happened there?
Yeah, in the end of 2005, our last game was against Sydney Swans. And, I know Jason Ball, the ruckman of Sydney, and I said, gee, you guys are going all right. If you win it this year, you're going, you know, you get another year easy. And he goes, no, I'm done and dusted. As soon as this year in 05 is finished, I'm finished. So, honestly, I approached Sydney and I said, well, if you need another ruckman, because I know Jason Ball's retiring. And they go, how do you know that? And I said, it doesn't matter, but I know he is. I'm happy to, you know, leave Hawthorn and come up and play a couple of years at Sydney, try and, chase that flag. So, unfortunately, the deal didn't go through. Alistair Clarkson and, again, Hawthorn dealing with Sydney. It's not like today. I don't get a say and I don't, say, you know, I want to go to Sydney and I'm walking out on football clubs. You're allowed the football clubs to do the dealing. That's who you had the contract with. And, Hawthorn didn't do the deal. So that means I was left at, I stayed at Hawthorn and, We're a bit different. You know, I follow the NRL a little bit because, I live in Queensland, but, you know, they have players walking out all during the year. You know, they'll play with some team on Sunday. Next Sunday, they'll be somewhere else. And it's ridiculous. And we don't do that in the AFL. And I understand that. So after the players realised that I did want to go to Sydney, I was let go out of the leadership group. And, you know, players weren't totally happy with that decision. So I understood that. Because I'd be exactly the same if a player did that, and I was in that team as well. So it was a hard year, but come out, the first half and played okay, and then got injured, and then realistically, when I was injured, they said don't even bother coming in. You might as well, you're going to be leaving at the end of the year anyway, so you can do your recovery and rehab on your own, and good luck, enjoy your footy. So it was probably the toughest year of football in 06.
Do you have any regrets about how you dealt with that? Pete, like looking back, that team would win a premiership 2 years later.
Yeah, it is. And, you always sit back there and go, okay, if I buy into Clarko and push myself, I could have. There's a lot of other bits and pieces. So not really. Yeah, probably regret that I didn't get to Sydney that year. They played in the grand final and needed a ruckman against West Coast in 06. So you can look at it either way and go, you know what, if I was there, could they have won it? You never know. So you kind of, it's a tough one. You make those decisions. Who knows? But that's the way it unfolded. But there was no doubt if I had said and 100% committed and brought into Clarko's philosophies, yeah, I probably would have been there in 08.
So you eventually did make it up to Sydney under another probably eventually Hall of Fame coach in Paul Roos at the time. What was it like going to Sydney from Melbourne after spending so much time in the spotlight in Melbourne then to sort of almost disappear up in Sydney?
Yeah, look, I enjoyed seeing how Sydney operated as a town, and yeah, it was completely different to Melbourne. And I remember just walking into the SCG with Hawley one day, and there was probably 600 kids out the front waiting for the cricket to start. It was a pre-season that we were going to training for, and you know, we walked past 600 kids, and not one of them said hello. And we're like, wow, hang on, this is Barry Hall. He's won you the guys a premiership in, you know, a couple of years ago, and you can't even say hello to him. But no one knew. You know, it was really fascinating. Where if that was Melbourne and, you know, you had Luke Hodge walking past Xavier College with, you know, 600 kids out the front, he would have got, you know, smashed and hassled and, you know, autographs and everything. So it was a real interesting time. But at the same time, you know, to be able to go up there and see how a club interstate is ran, it was just totally different. And Clarko was starting to get on the same page in Hawthorn, but Sydney was so advanced in just even all their recovery techniques, their dietary, you know, even their planning. You know, you'd say where we're going to be in June the 5th, you know, on May the 4th or whatever. Like, they just planned the whole season ahead. You knew exactly where you're doing, you know, before every game. It was just so structured and so in a semi-way robotic. But you know what? Everyone knew what they were doing. Everyone knew what they were required to do. And it was a system that absolutely worked.
Some of the players you played with at Sydney, Barry Hall, you reunited with him after a time in St Kilda. What was it like reuniting and seeing both ends of the spectrum of Barry Hall?
Yeah, well, and, you know, I was close to Barry when we played up there. But, yeah, you're right. It was, you know, St Kilda days when he was half mad and we were going out enjoying ourselves and pulling people out of cabs and getting home at 3 a.m. to now watching somebody who just smashing the weights room. Every time he trained, it was at 100%, went out there more focused and a leader as well. It was great to, you know, and they're the stories you like to see the transformation from. And, you know, be able to go from that coming out of Broadford and, you know, change your whole lifestyle to what you've been able to achieve. And, yeah, there's so many great stories like that, you know, especially through the 90s when it went from, you know, just to, not bush footy, but, you know, it went to top grade footy, but it wasn't professional to absolutely full-time professional. That's all you do. It was interesting.
You've got Adam Goods at the club as well. Surely some of the stardom, you said it wasn't much going around for the Swans, but surely there was a bit of an aura around Adam Goods at that time.
Oh, yeah. There always is. The way I remember playing against him and, you know, he did his PCL and you think he's going to be out for 6 weeks and he comes out the next week against us and, you know, has 32 touches off the halfback flank. So it didn't matter where he played. He prepared that way too, though. He trained every session. He never missed a session. He did everything absolutely perfect, you know, stretching and recovery. And, you know, just to, you know, it never amazed you. Whenever he got near the ball, you knew something special was going to happen. And you can play him. That was the freakish nature. You could play down back, play up forward, play on the ruck, play ruck rover, play rover. He could do anything. So, yeah, 07 was always, you know, you kind of hoped you could, you know, hang on and you know, produce another grand final. We got to the finals, and to be honest, it was nearly one of my only, well, it was the only finals that I got through. And it was good to play, but unfortunately, it didn't go our way.
Well, 2008, you went all the way to the semi final and eventually lost to the Western Bulldogs. That would be your last game at the AFL level. You still played 16 games in 2008. Was there anything left in your body where you thought you probably could have gone on?
Not really. I think mentally more so than anything. You know, this is when computers and meetings start to really take over. And, you know, I'd pretty much designed my first trip around Australia during our team meetings of the last 8 rounds. So I didn't really, yeah. And I had a chat with Roosie. Roosie was really good. He goes, you know what, it's not about the 18 games or the 20 games next year. It's about just getting through the pre-season and how does your body feel. And, you know, when you look at, you know, back to, you know, the better years you played and just your jump and your bounce and being able to get your body up again, you sat there and go, if I really pushed, I probably could have got another year. But mentally, Did I really want another year? And, I was pretty much done. So I was happy to walk away at the end of that year.
So looking back on your year now, look back on your career now, I've read recently that you'd stopped drinking. Has that continued now to this day?
Yeah, gave it up for 6 months, and occasional one, but not many now, not compared to how I was. So yeah, giving it up tried it for a few little while, and I thought, oh, this is all right. It's actually suited me a lot better. I can't believe, I've actually enjoyed it, which is surprising, and I don't actually miss it. So yeah, it was something that I just decided to do just before going on a golf day with a group of mates. It wasn't the best idea when it was 35 degrees, but I thought if I'm ever going to be challenged, it's going to be then. And so look, am I ever going to have a beer again? Yeah, but am I ever going to drink like I used to? No.
16 seasons in the AFL, drinking a lot at St Kilda. Do you ever look back and think how it was possible being a young player, like potentially drinking a lot based on what you were saying?
Yeah, you look back now and, you sit there and go, gee, how? And we had quite a few players, Jason Cripps, Nathan Burke that didn't drink, quite a few, and you always laughed and said, you're kidding yourselves, aren't you? And even Harves didn't drink a lot, but, us younger blokes probably, we did. You always wonder now what it could have been like, what it will be like, but you can't sit there and hold that. I kind of sit there and still go, you're still fortunate enough to play 291 games. So, you might as well be happy with that.
That's right, 291 games, 3 All-Australians, a couple best and fairest in there as well across multiple teams. Thanks so much for your time, Spider. Is there anything you want to add before we wrap up for the day? I've kept you way too long in the end.
No, that's fine. No worries at all. No, it was always interesting and, something that, I was very, very proud to be a part of. But more importantly, I think, even to be able to play one game against my brother. My brother played at the Western Bulldogs and we played against each other in Sydney. So that was one of the highlights, just to be able to, have two brothers play against each other when I think there's 13 or 14 years difference. It was, that was probably the other highlight that,
BT50. It is the complete package. Don't forget, on Monday, the 2-minute warning. Get your questions in from then. Like, subscribe the podcast if you can, and write us a little review as well. Talk to you next week, and thanks again.